welcome to Season 7 of The Process Podcast, an interview series exploring the process of survival as a creative. For this season, we're going back to our roots and talking to all sorts of creatives from a wide variety of industries, backgrounds, and creative endeavors about how they make it all work, from mental health to relationships to money to the creative process itself, and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Shannon Byrne, and I'm just trying to figure it out like the rest of us. Big thanks to the band Blessed for letting us use our song Endure as our intro music for this season. You can find their music at Blessed, that's B-L-E-S-S-E-D, band.bandcamp.com, or wherever you buy your music. And to Hannah Spencer for all of the design and branding and the strategy work she does for us. And Lonnie Webb for running our social media. Thank you for listening. Hope y'all dig it. Hi. Hello. Episode 79 of The Process. I guess I'm saying episode numbers now. It's new, but it makes me feel more accomplished as we creep up towards slowly to episode 100, because, you know, who doesn't love a good milestone? I know it's like a vanity thing and probably void of much meaning, but there's something to be said about getting to 100 episodes. So we're at episode 79. We're close. And this one is with stand-up comedian Harry Morrows. Before I dive into his bio, Harry is a friend. He is also the partner, significant other, fiance of Hannah Spencer, who does all of our design and branding and makes a couple of cameos, quite the cameos, on this episode. I have a lot of favorite couples, but they're up there. They're high up there. They're definitely my favorite couple in LA. Also, before I get into his bio, Hannah was giving him a haircut at the beginning of this episode, so you'll hear a little bit of razor going, but it stops after a few minutes, and it makes it hilarious. I was cracking up laughing editing this episode. That's because Harry is a stand-up comedian. Very funny person. He came up in the Detroit comedy scene in the late 2000s. And as mentioned, now he resides in LA. He has performed in festivals like Riot LA, SF Sketchfest, Desert Hearts Festival, Gilda's Laugh Fest, Laughing Skull Festival, Laugh Your Asheville Off, Beast Village, among others. And he frequently tours throughout the US and Canada. He also runs Crane's Comedy Night in LA with some friends, as well as Dirt Pit Lounge, both in LA. I am now blanking on what nights they are, but we mentioned that in this episode. You can also find links to all of those things at theprocess.co, or just go to harrymorrows.com to see his schedule and when those things are, when you can catch some comedy. Additionally, Harry's work has appeared on Adult Swim, and his voice can be heard in YouTube Red's Do You Want to See a Dead Body? As well as LOL Network's Campus Law. He was featured as villainous pie guy in the web series An Afternoon, and was a man amongst children, portrayed Philip, 14-year-old unicycle prodigy, on season 3 of Disney's Ant Farm. That's because Harry and his family all learned how to unicycle together and, like, became professionals. You hear us talk about it. It was quite the plot twist and, of course, hilarious. He's also an editor and has worked on shows like Mystery Science Theater and Children's Hospital. In this episode, we of course talk about how and why he got into comedy, the delusions that you adopt early in comedy in order to build the thick skin needed, his experiences with his short-term modeling career, what the Detroit comedy community is like and how it's different from LA's. He really walks us through how the comedy scene works in LA, how people make money and don't make money, and what they do to come up in the scene, as well as his experience of running the Crane's Comedy and Dirt Pit Lounge, and how his day job as an editor influences comedy and directorial career, because he's also worked on a pilot and he shares that experience with us, and also his joke writing process, advice to up-and-coming comedians, and a whole lot more. I hope you have fun with this episode, as much fun as we did. There's a lot of laughter in it, which I love. Second episode of the season, and like a lot of laughter so far. I'm truly digging it. Again, check out theprocess.co for show notes and links to everything we talk about and where you can find Harry. Hope you dig it. Catch you next week.
So, Harry.
What's up? Off to a fun start. This is great.
Who are you?
I'm Harry Morrows. I'm in a bathroom that I own or rent, getting my hair cut by my significant other, Hannah, my fiance, my partner, and I'm a stand-up comedian. Yep. Is that good?
That's good.
That's a pretty good description. Yeah, covers everything.
That's a great description. This is our first podcast interview during haircut.
Making history.
Yeah. Why comedy?
It just always seems so fun. I know that's like a stupid answer, but I was always into it. I was really short growing up, like really short, like 4'11" high school short, right?
Yep. For listeners, you are not short anymore.
Yeah, that's very true. Now I'm 4'22". Actually, I'm taller than that. That's like still 5'10". That's not even that tall. No. I'm taller than 4'22". I'm 4'26" or something. But it was just like a nice defensive mechanism. And like, I also play a lot of basketball, and that involved a lot of trash talking. And trash talking is all comedy, essentially. It's like bravado and jokes. And like goading somebody else on, making fun of people. I was also a bully growing up because short people can be bullies. You know, equal rights people.
Like you had a young person Napoleon complex?
Yeah, absolutely. I was a baby Napoleon. Baby nap. I'm taking baby naps. And also, like, I had trouble sleeping at night, so my parents would put on stand-up comedy albums to, like, get me focused on something. Started with Bill Cosby, and surprise, surprise, that put me right to sleep, right?
What, like, how old are you?
Five or six. Yeah. So, like, right off the gate, a lot of, again, Cosby, a lot of George Carlin, Richard Pryor, Red Fox.
Seems very advanced, isn't that? I'm trying to not say inappropriate.
Is it inappropriate? I don't know, like...
But those just seem like very, like, adult comedy for a kid that young.
Cosby's for super young kids.
Not like, Cosby, but, like... Carlin and
early Carlin. Early Carlin is very kid friendly too. It's like class clowny, goofy stuff. Okay. He later on in life got more into like political ranty and like kind of conceptual stuff. But even as he was advancing as a comedian, he went for kind of weird sounds. And as a kid, weird sounds are A plus because everybody knows weird sounds are funny.
Yeah.
You don't need to like understand the hierarchy or like why cemeteries are bad and golf courses are bad and stuff like that to really get it. I don't know. I don't think my parents are thinking that much about anything. They're just like, their laughs, let the kid laugh, he won't be scared. Great right. stuff. I think that's how I got into comedy, and then I went to school for politics and that didn't go great, and I got out of school and got into broiness and that did go great. That was super awesome. I was a super bro. And then I just stumbled upon an open mic and started doing that, and it's been taken off ever since.
So you were scared to go to sleep? That's...
Well, yeah, I mean, kids are scared of monsters and stuff under the bed, right? So I was freaking out about, like, the Hairy Man, which is, like, some fairy tale that I heard on, like, book on tape. This kid Wiley and the Hairy Man, and it's, like, this Hairy Man, like, abducted kids and stuff. And I was like, ah! Hairy Man's gonna grab
Harry.
Like,
why do you name me Harry?
Well, yeah, I thought that might like help me out a little bit. Like, we can relate, Hairy Man. I'm a Hairy Man, I'm a Hairy Boy. I did think I had a little in if Hairy Man ever came my way, but there were other monsters as well. You know, monsters are big in the kid community.
Yeah, that's true. At what point did you realize that you were funny?
Pretty quickly, and I don't know if I like realized or just decided I was funny, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, even now, I don't know if Hannah thinks I'm all that funny. But I still do what I do, you know? The first laugh I can remember getting was, I memorized Shel Silverstein poems in elementary school, like first grade, kindergarten. I used to recite them and like kind of act them out and stuff, and other kids in school thought that was hilarious. So that's early comedy stuff I can remember. And like I said, also early trash talking in basketball, which as a short kid, like you have to talk shit. Otherwise, like, you suck, dude. Like, get off the court.
Yeah. And obviously the other kids playing basketball would laugh at that.
Oh, yeah, they loved it. I mean, as long as they weren't, like, the butt of the joke, you know.
Right.
Which, someone's always the butt of the joke, and so someone's feelings are always hurt, but 99% of the other people having a great time.
Did you mostly make fun of other people rather than yourself?
Yeah, I never really made fun of myself. I was, I was pretty vain. Still kind of am, you know. It just grew into acceptable after a little while.
How did the first open mic go? Like, obviously you enjoyed it enough to keep going, but, like...
Oh, yeah, I thought I was the bomb. I was, like, I did. I was at hype broiness, right? Like, I was unemployed, I was drinking a lot, I was working out every day, and, like, I was making money doing modeling stuff, so my confidence level was an all-time high. Plus, I was freshly tall and, like, weighed a decent amount for the first time ever in my life, so it was just, like, an insane amount of confidence. And so I went on stage, I had these jokes written. I think two of the five jokes went okay, not great. By any stretch of the imagination, but okay. And when you start stand-up, you're like, Mike Birbiglia even said this, you have like these delusions of how good you actually are. Mm-hmm. And after that, after three open mics in Michigan, I was like, I can take this to LA, I'm going to kill. And that's what I did. So I didn't develop too much in Michigan or even in LA until like my second stint here, I'd say.
You have been in LA once before and then you left and came back?
Mm-hmm.
When was that?
So after I graduated college, I stuck around in Michigan for a little bit, boozed it up, started comedy. Then I moved to LA in like 2009, I think. 2009, for those who don't understand shortening dates. For those unfamiliar with aught abbreviations. So I moved out here to do modeling and stuff, and like that was going okay until it was not going okay.
Like, wait, what was the turning point?
It just got too creepy. Like,
what kind of modeling were you doing?
Let's just, I have a joke about it, but like, it's so easy to get manipulated with compliments. It's not like models are dumb, it's just like, it's very easy to be talked into stuff. And I can remember like, what there'd be times people like, oh, your bone structure's great, and I'm just like feasting on these compliments, and the next thing I know I'm in the woods naked with a broadsword in front of my dick. I'm like, wait, what magazine is this for again? And they're like, magazine.
Oh, God.
Oh, no. A lot of private collections, a lot of photographers. Not, this isn't the case for all photographers, but like a lot of people see like an opportunity to be really creepy. This one dude told me, he's like, oh, I'm asexual, but I'm really into textures. And I was like, okay, well, I don't know what to get about that, but please just snap away with the camera and leave the fingers to themselves, you know?
Yeah.
So after a while, especially moving out here, it just got very predatory. And also, I didn't have
any
money.
That's terrible.
Yeah, it's terrible, but you know, whatever. I look good. Who gives a shit? The trauma was fine. I don't know. It didn't destroy me or anything like that. So when I moved out here, I just kind of stopped doing that, and I started working in the movie trailer industry, and I got fired from that pretty quickly. I've been fired a whole bunch in my life. Can't hold down too many jibs. But after that, I started working as a video game tester, and that was easy because I just played video games all day. I wasn't good at it. I got fired from that job too, actually.
You got laid off.
I did get laid off. That's fair. Or my contract is up, and they didn't do anything. But they did tell me when they let me go, that they wanted to fire me like a month in, but I kept morale up too much, so they just kept me around for a good time. Like, that was a sweet gig.
You were like, who am I, your clown?
Yeah, I guess. I don't care. Feed me drugs, put me on the video game, make you smile. Like, those jobs are depressing as hell. They needed somebody like that.
Yeah.
I tell myself.
Well, clearly, they kept you around.
For some extended time. And so I was out here, and like, I was kind of doing stand up, but not really. Just trying to figure out, like, what to do. And out here, I didn't know what to do comedy-wise either, because I just knew of open mics in Michigan at the clubs. And then out here, you have, like, the Comedy Store and the Improv. And I didn't really know how to get into there. But then I got invited to do these bringer shows. And those are a scam, always. But I didn't know that at the time.
What are they called?
It's a bringer show when you get to perform, but only if you bring so many people who have to pay a ton of money to go to the show.
Oh.
And you don't get paid to do the show.
Yeah, definitely so, a scam.
For sure a scam. Yeah. But stage time. And I met some of my best friends in comedy doing that, because, you know, you start somewhere, you have to get, like, an in.
Yeah.
And so I was doing that for, like, a little while. Near the end of that time period, I wasn't planning on moving back to Michigan, but Hannah came out and visited this girl that was living on our couch, and she and I hit it off pretty good and started dating after that week. And then I decided I wanted to continue that relationship after distance proved to be pretty difficult. So I moved back to Michigan in with her, and then just started hitting comedy pretty hardcore in Michigan before moving back out to L.A., after Hannah finished school, and I thought I was big enough for the second time to be falsely the case. Two wrong turns on my part, but we're out here. We're doing all right. Sorry for shrugging, Hannah.
Yeah, you're doing fine.
Yeah, I'm doing great. I can't complain. I got a goddamn credenza. I made it, you know?
What was it like building when you went back to Michigan and like, we're a little bit more serious about your comedy career. Like, what was it like coming up there?
It was great because the community was so small. There was a class before us that I'm still, like, friends with some of the people who were on the younger end of that class that moved on.
Class, did you go to, like, a comedy thing?
No, it's just, like, generations of comedians.
Okay.
Right? So there were, like, five or six comedians that I knew and, like, three or four of them that I still talk to that were moving to, like, New York and had moved on from Los Angeles, or moved on from the Detroit scene at the time. And then there were guys, when I moved back to Michigan, that were already at, like, top of the Michigan chain comedy-wise, and that was Ricardo Flanagan, who's out here now, and Trevor Smith, who I run Crane's Comedy with, along with Corbin Recky. And so those two guys were, like, the big names in comedy in Michigan, and they were still just doing, like, the open mic scene and stuff like that. So there were, like, 12 to 15 of us, at least in the Metro Detroit area, that were taking it seriously and, like, really going after that. And that was fun because we're all new to it, and it was all such, like, a young community, and so you're all friends with each other, and you're watching everybody develop and seeing who's making what moves, and it seems so small that everyone's involved with essentially the same opportunities. And that's where I met Corbin as well. He saw me at an open mic, and then followed me to a grocery store job that I had, and gave me free marijuana and became my friend from that point on. It's a friendship that's lasted 13 years or something at this point. I guess not 13, but like 8 or so years. And so even Hannah knew like a lot of the comedians. She was friends with a whole bunch of them. And then when we moved out here, it was not the case because everyone's trying to be in the spotlight and the spectacle. And you're also so focused on making it and doing everything you can as opposed to like kind of enjoying the ride. It's just, it's tougher, especially for significant others, I think.
Yeah. So you never like went to improv class or any, like you never took any classes?
I took an acting class in college with a whole bunch of athletes. So I shined and did in that. And then I went to this thing in Michigan called Go Comedy in Ferndale. It's a pretty fun little improv club, improv theater. And I took a couple classes from there and was like in a tournament with my group. Troupe du jour, Aaron Floor of that group is out here now, and the other two are still in Michigan. But, like, improv is just, I like doing it, I just don't like relying on other people all that much. I have, like, issues with control a little bit, and stand-up just allows that to be great. And I, with the jokes, when you come up with a joke, it already happens in your brain, so you already get it. The question is making it understood to the people that you're trying to convey it to, so trying to break down how you communicate it to, like, another person is tough enough when it's just you and another person as opposed to, like, a whole team of people trying to build something together. I also don't think I was peppy enough for improv. I got a lot of, it doesn't have to be so dark. You don't have to be so negative. And I'm like, you don't have to be on Prozac or whatever the fuck you're on right now. It's crazy.
This is comedy.
It's a weird scene. Exactly. Yeah. It's comedy. Comedy is the light and darkness, I think. So, yeah. I don't know. Stand-up was so easy to go about doing. That's always the route of comedy I enjoyed, and I always had a feeling I was going to end up doing it at some point. And improv just takes away from it.
So what does your comedy career look like today? Like, tell me about the shows that you run and what you like, your own performances.
So I get paid a little bit to do stand-up. Like, I'll tour a couple times a year, make some money that way. I do a lot of showcases in L.A. L.A. is not a great place to make money doing stand-up. It's or any art, really.
Or, like, music, or, yeah. Right. I think, like, visual artists, if you get to a certain level.
I guess we get to a certain level. Yeah. But even then, you're doing a lot of your own galleries trying to show off to people.
Right.
You know, and so it's, you come here to get seen, so someone tries to invest in you to send you elsewhere to get paid, right?
Okay.
And in everywhere else in the country, with the exception of New York, even New York, you paid a little bit. But you're performing at places for people who need to laugh because their life fucking blows. Mm. And they just need a break from it. Whether overall it blows or in the moment it blows. They just need a break. So people are paying money for tickets. They want to go see something. And it is like a job. You're like out there working and stuff. So there's more money in it that way. But at the same time, you're also traveling around all over the place. So you're spending money doing that. You're staying in these hotels, paying money for that. You're not eating all that great. As opposed to just living in LA, which is a treat in itself.
Right.
But I run two shows here that I lose money on every month. So please, people, come out so I can start making money on them. It'd be nice.
Or at least break even.
They're free. Yeah, just to pay for the drinks and we'll be fine.
Yeah.
But I run one. It's an outdoor show called Dirt Pit Lounge, which is these people's yard that they just turned into a bar. They asked me, my friend was like, yo, do you want to do a comedy show at the Dirt Pit Lounge? And I said, no, that sounds terrible. But I went there and it's actually pretty awesome. If you guys are into raccoons, they show up a whole bunch. The longer comedy show I've been running is downtown Los Angeles. It's called Crane's Comedy. It's at Crane's Bar downtown. And I run that with the aforementioned Trevor Smith and Corbin Recchi, as well as Trish Hadley, who was my boss at Abominable, where I worked on shows like Mystery Science Theater and Children's Hospital. And both those shows are free. They're just straight-up stand-up showcases. They're once a month. And it's great because they get to get the biggest names in comedy because they're all in L.A. doing these shows. It's a lot of fun.
So you lose money because they... You need to pay like a drink, a beverage minimum or something?
Well, for the outdoor show, we got to pay for drinks, and we also pay photographers to be at the shows, to take pictures. And I mean, photographers are like kind of cheap, but not really. They shouldn't be as inexpensive as they are. I hope they don't listen to this podcast and start charging me more.
Yeah.
But also, we have to pay for speakers, microphones, all the equipment and stuff. And then if you're advertising, trying to get people to come out for the show, that costs money as well. Printing out posters, printing out flyers. At Crane's, we give gifts to the comedians that are on the show as well. So...
Do they also get paid, or they just get
paid? They don't get paid, because we don't really get paid. Like, it's just, we could pay, but, like, a lot of shows out here don't. I wish they would. I would love to pay, but we'd have to charge for tickets, and at this point, we can't, like, change over to that.
Right. And so comedians are doing it for the stage time,
Well, yeah, for the stage time, because you benefit from, one, performing is a drug. It feels friggin' great. And if I think it feels just as good for the performer as it does for the audience. Like, it's a very equal payoff. And you guys are both lost in the moment, right?
Right.
Person on stage is lost because they're having a blast. People off stage forgot about whatever is paining them mentally at the point. It's just your brain's turned off for a second. And for the performer, they also get to practice and they get to showcase in front of industry. And in L.A., maybe someone sees you and like, oh, I can put this person on a TV show or in a movie or something like that. So a lot of shows matter. And the more shows that you're on, the more successful it looks like you are and the more people can think about your name. So like just seeing your name on posters digitally is a lot for some people. There are very funny comedians out here who don't get on a lot of shows, so nobody knows who the fuck they are. And they probably never will, if I'm being honest, because they're just missing that part of their game.
What do you think it takes to
make a dream come true?
Yeah.
I think it takes two to make a dream come true. You got to be uncomfortable. You have to work super hard, and you got to be out there all the time. Like, presence is a big deal. Presence and determination, and also be a fucking nice person. You don't have to be. You can be a real dipshit and still succeed, but, like, what kind of life is that to lead? And
right.
you're risking burning a lot of bridges along the way.
Yeah. Can you speak to your pilot and the vision for that and, like, essentially how you see it all working together from your... We also haven't touched on how you, like, pay the bills either.
Oh, yeah.
From, like, your stand-up, your day job, the pilot, like, what...
Yeah, so my day job is I edit TV shows. I'm working for Cartoon Network right now on an undisclosable project, but... If you're between the ages of 6 and 20 in the future, you're gonna love it! You're gonna dig it, I think so. But it's not something I created, I just edit the show. I'm the animatic editor in this case for these. And then, usually I'm editing live-action TV shows. Like I said, with Mr. Science Theater and the like before. This other show that's on YouTube Red called Do You Want to See a Dead Body? And so, working as an editor is great because if you want to be, like, working in TV, you can see how directing should happen, like what shots you need to make a show work. And it works with stand-up too because both editing and performing are about timing. It is like very timing-based, so like I feel like it helps me in that world, and also it helps me see behind the scenes of what I need to do to create a show myself, and I build connections with like producers and networks and stuff. So as you alluded to, I shot a pilot presentation that myself, Corbin, and a couple of the guys funded and created. Corbin and I created it, and we got a producer, Pete Wazell, and a director and producer, Josh Jolcover, to work on it. We shot like a little sizzle for that, and now we're pitching that around to a whole bunch of different production companies and like little studios to be like, hey, we want to make this a full series. Here's the place that we see it working. This is how we see it working. So you have to practice a pitch for that. You got to figure out why you have something to offer a company that should want that, and also what that company can do for you. And it's all about trying to find the best fit. And a bit, like I said before, I have control issues, so I want to be able to like kind of have a lot of control in this project. Sometimes you sell a show and it's out of your hands. You can't do anything. Other times they pair you with a showrunner who's way more experienced than you are because you have no credits, and you don't get to make any decisions in that show. And that's like kind of a bummer too. But because I've been working so much in TV, I feel like depending on what the company is, I can maybe bully my way into a lot more power than potentially a lot of first-time showrunners would get.
Well, all right, how did you get into editing? You went to school for politics. How did you...
I was always editing because I was making comedy videos when I was a kid. We had two VCRs, and that's how you start editing. You take one tape, you cut it into the next tape, so you can shoot stuff out of sync, but you just have one master tape that you keep putting your scenes onto.
Okay.
And then after that, my mom got me an editing software called Dazzle, which was pretty shaky, but it worked okay. And then I got this other system called Pinnacle, which was also pretty rough. So I was just editing these comedy videos, a lot of Jackass style videos, you know, like we'd play nutball where we'd throw a hard ball or a bone at each other's nuts while sitting down and see who could last the longest, dress up in costume.
How old were you doing?
What was it, like 26, 27? No, like, this is like 17. I'd say 16 or 17 years old. I was crazy at 16, 17 for like a suburb kid, I guess. What sort of stuff you do and whatnot. So, and then my high school, I went to a pretty wealthy public high school. Like the city I grew up in, we moved there, and then around us, all these crazy rich ass people moved in. Which some of my friends are rich and that's fine, but their parents can suck ass. Living in a rich city like really made me dislike wealthy people quite a bit. But our school benefited greatly because it's like super well funded, and they built a whole new wing specifically for broadcasting, And because I and one other person were the only two people at the time who knew anything about editing, we kind of got to, as students, run a lot of that department. So we just got run of the mill to do whatever we wanted. So I was doing that in high school. I didn't really know it was like a job opportunity. I just thought it was fun stuff. And also, while we were doing video editing, we were recording rap albums, and we were way more focused on becoming rappers. And we actually spent a lot of college recording a couple of albums that we thought were going to take us the distance.
So you were a white, self-identifying bro.
Yes.
Rapper.
Grew up on 8 Mile. No big deal. Think about 8 Mile, it's a very long street. but still Metro Detroit, you know. We did a lot of rapping stuff, and that helped a lot with editing, too. And then when I was in college, because I was doing like all the rapping, and I started out in politics, and it didn't work out very well, and college just wasn't going very well for me as a whole. I just wanted to get out, but I also wanted to graduate. And my buddy was in telecommunication, and he was like, oh, it requires a lot of editing, so maybe you should come into this major. So that's why I switched over to just to get out of school.
Okay.
And so I got a degree, I got some connections out of it, and so that's been working for me ever since. If I'm being honest, if anybody out there wants to edit, that's like their game, or if they want to direct, just make your own stuff and someone's going to give you a job. Like, you have to meet people and you got to be nice. But, like, go to places. Send emails to editors, because editors love attention because they don't get any respect for doing anything. The people who won the editing Oscar this year, it's like, it's a widely discussed thing that their only reason that they're talked about editing-wise is because the editing's so bad. Like, if you notice the editing, it's bad editing. And it's wild that you should get an award for it.
But yeah.
No, usually, like, if editing's very good, it seems seamless. You're just lost in the story.
Who won the...
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Okay.
I don't know who to... I don't want to talk too much shit about it, but...
Yeah.
if you do a bad job, you shouldn't be rewarded.
Am I done?
Yeah. Oh, great. Thank you, Hannah. Give it up for Hannah, everybody.
Woo!
Hannah had a good question. Or this episode's going to be all over the place.
That's fine. Surprise me with it. Are you recording right now?
Yeah.
Great.
Your process for writing jokes.
I've been waiting for that question.
I know.
From the beginning. It can happen one of two ways. One, I can be like just free writing somewhere. I do my best writing like at cafes, kind of people watching. And also, you're outside. So it just, everything feels right. I don't know what it is about that. Or a lot of times it's just like a thought comes into my head or from like some conversation or from like a podcast recording or something. I'll riff on something and then that will become a bigger and bigger joke if I keep developing it. Usually an idea sparks. I think it's funny. I tell it to Hannah. If she laughs and says, that's stupid, it's going to be fucking great. And sometimes I'll think of something, I know it's funny, but I don't know how to communicate it. And I don't want to tell Hannah because I don't want her to be like, that's terrible. And then, you know, be against it. So she's like my first pass for jokes. But like I'll think of something and then I'll test it on a couple people in casual conversation just to see how it goes down. I know I'm not supposed to be doing that. I know you shouldn't
be
like
what you're doing to me last night.
It's true. I was. I did do it a lot. But some of it was casual, right?
Yeah.
Like
I think the only ones that I really noticed were the one that flopped.
Yeah, that was the worst. that
one. I was like, what do I say to that?
Boo, I think. Boo would have been appropriate. But for example, like in conversation yesterday, that bit about like naming kids, if I had a boy, I'm going to name him Cholula after my favorite hot sauce, Cholula Frank Moros. Like that's a joke I'll tell on stage probably and see what I can do with it. To make it grow, I say it on stage and then I try to riff afterward and see if anything comes up. Or I'll sit down and try to write different angles from it. But where I've had the most success is in the shower. I'm a Pisces water boy. What can I say? Swim team captain, blue eyes, like fucking Michigan dude. There's just something about the shower that I love so much. This sounds like static, right? It just bouncing off the walls.
There's no other stimulation.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, yeah. There's the heat and there's that.
Right.
And the aromas as well of whatever your body washes.
No distractions, I guess is what I meant.
No distractions for sure. Unless I catch like a glimpse of my body and then I'm distracted for a second. And I'm like, damn, dude, still got it. Look down at my knot tattoo or where it should be. In the shower, it's great because also, for whatever reason, I don't know if you've noticed when you sing in the shower. If you sing in the shower, I do all the time, and I'm a terrible singer.
I don't sing in the shower. I sing in the car.
Oh, you should try in the shower because you'll hit notes you've never been able to hit before. Mm. Like, there's something about the moisture in the air that, like, loosens up your vocal cords, I think, a little bit.
So I can just like talk.
I can sing high.
Yeah, absolutely. You can get Frankie Valli style if you want to. Celine Dion. I don't know what Mariah Carey is that one.
Yeah, Mariah Carey.
Great.
It's like the one I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in the shower, I can just like riff and do act outs and stuff, and there's like no one else around, and it's just me. So I can get crazy, and like doing well on stage is all about commitment. So you have to, if you have an idea for a bit, maybe it's not working well because you're not committed to performing it well or to making it better, figuring out what the funny sound is. And there's so much that goes into writing a joke. It's not just the idea that's funny. It's what words you choose, the pauses you put, the hand gestures you have, your facial expressions, the sounds you make while doing it. If you do an act out, if you don't do an act out. So while you're making a joke, you have to try all these things.
Hold on. What's an act out?
An act out is if I say, I describe like a scene. You know, I'm like, you ever going to get like some coffee? This is like a terrible, like this isn't actually a joke of mine, but this is just an example. Like, you ever in coffee and the person in front of you is taking too long to order, and they're like, what does mocha mean? And you're like, oh God, what? And so you pretend to be a person or a thing.
Right.
So you're just acting out the scene, essentially. Which is good, especially if you want to be, you know, an actor on TV, let people see what you can do.
Right.
Usually that's, like, I get a base idea for a joke, I try to communicate it, sometimes it works well, sometimes it doesn't. If I still believe in it, I try to get into a different state of mind or a different place, sometimes through marijuana, sometimes on my own, sometimes I tweet it. It's always a bad idea, I think, just tweeting the jokes, because tweeting jokes is, like, a different medium completely. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I'll write out my jokes long. Like, if you see my notebooks, if you see my set list, it's just one word or two words here and there, and it's like scattered all over the place. And if I just think of a joke idea and I need to move on quickly in a place, or if I'm like with company, I'll scribble down some like key words, and that's it.
Do you always remember it? Do you always like look at it and you're like, that's what that was?
No. Well, I mean, with like bits I've done before, if I see one word, I know what it is.
Okay.
But for like newer ideas, my memory is awful. Like, my memory's never been good. And I probably should just, like, move away from people and just write out the whole bit, which is what I have to do eventually, which is also helpful because if a bit's not going all that well, if you write it out in long form, you can see which sentences aren't good or aren't necessary. You can just cross it out, and then you can jump from thing to thing without having to, like, use your mind to, like, make it happen.
Yeah.
So I'm not like Jay-Z. I need to write my shit down.
Yeah. When you're writing your jokes out, you're, like, journaling them?
Mm-hmm.
Use like pen and paper.
Notebooks. Okay. I love notebooks. Hannah hates how many notebooks I have, but I love having them. I'm never going to get rid of them. I'm never going to stop writing into them. It's always been how I remember stuff is writing it down, and then I never have to look at it again. It's there forever. That's how, that for me, school was, this is going to sound bad, it was so easy. Like, it was a fucking joke. And it was just because I'd sit in class and I'd write the notes down once and I would never study again. Like, it didn't matter. It was all in because I could hear it, and I was visualizing the words as I was writing it down. So when I'm writing jokes down, I've already thought of it. I don't need to hear it. And then when I'm writing it down, I can see what my thoughts are and watch how long it takes for stuff to play out.
Right. And if you were to write it again, then you'd have the ability to edit it down and
correct,
be able to cut out stuff that you don't need.
Absolutely.
Right. So you were also talking about act outs?
Act outs.
When I interrupted you. Now you're able to do that in the shower.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what's, like, step? We're at, like, step 2.5, I think.
Yeah.
You first pass it by Hannah.
Yeah. And she says,
people,
you're an idiot. And I'm like, this is great. And then I do it. Then I, like, practice it a little bit. Some people will go to, like, no mic with nothing to talk about. And that's, like, fine and dandy, I guess. But I just don't want to do that. I don't want to waste anyone's time. Time is so valuable, especially in this city. You only get 3 minutes on stage at these open mics sometimes. So I want to take advantage of those times when I have them. And it shows. Every show matters. Every show is very important.
Do you think that's something that most comedians today value and hold true? Do you think they all see?
What I see?
That every show matters.
The successful ones do, but not every comedian is successful. I'm not even that successful. Like, I do okay, but there are huge steps I can take forward. And the people who are more successful than I am, it seems like they treat every show like it really, really matters. So I do that, practice a joke, and then I take it to stage. Open mic first, almost always, but I get booked on enough shows where if I have a new joke I believe in, I'll just do it at a show. Hannah pointed out this thing I noticed, or she noticed, and I've been kind of using it for a while. We were at a music festival, and she pointed out that every band at that festival was doing their sets the exact same way, which was one new fun song that is like, oh, this song's pretty good, and then their new hit that people are hooked on, and then once they've got you in, then a whole bunch of new whatever stuff that they're working on, and then close on their most famous thing.
Yeah,
so
totally. It's still what, like, every single show at a certain level is.
Right? Mm-hmm. So with stand-up, it's kind of that same way. Like, why not treat it like that? And it's when you're on stage, it's very much your job to get the audience to like you kind of immediately, or mm-hmm. at least get you immediately so you can, like, go with it. It makes your life a lot easier, and you want to be good the entire way through. So when I have a new joke, I'll typically put it in, like, the middle of the set when stuff's already going well, just so I feel more confident saying it. It's also important to say it on shows because I'm so excited about those bits. These other bits I've said a million times, some of them for years, right? As opposed to new bit, like, I just did the show Hot Tub, which is, it's arguably the biggest alt show in Los Angeles, like, that's not, like, at a club. I had written this new bit about how I can do a monologue from any anime show, and I'd only told it at one open mic before, but it went so well, I was like, I've got to open my set with this. And it went fine. In retrospect, I wish I'd put it, like, a little deeper into the set, but I was just so sick of opening with the same joke that I've been opening with for a long time.
What was that?
It's just an I look like joke. It's about how I look like the white people that scares white people. You know, like, I look like a Russian bad guy, right. Essentially. And so then I do a joke about how you've never seen, like, a Russian hero and stuff like that. If you're interested, go to my website, harrymorrows.com. Peep the vids. It's in there for sure. So that's, like, step three is you tell on a show and you see how it goes. And then you keep telling it and you keep tweaking it. Because I record a lot of my sets. I should record more. But you should record, like, probably every set and listen to it. And then you can pinpoint where I didn't perform something properly, where a line just sounds weird, or where a line never gets a laugh. And so you can make changes after that, or you can make sounds happen different after that. Or you can see, oh, this, if you listen to it, you can be like, actually, an act out could go here, or actually, I could go in this direction. So a joke is always evolving, even though the base is always the same, I would say.
Yeah. Where does, you talked a little bit about where you get jokes from, like, everyday life stuff,
but mm-hmm.
typically, where does your inspiration for jokes come from? Like, is a lot of it your own experiences and, like, about you, or is it about, like,
is it more autobiographical or observational?
Yeah.
I'm a mix of both. I'd say, like, my material is very, like, silly, real world, but surreal takes on the real world. It's goofy and dumb. I think it plays well to stupid people. Because I'm not like, the brightest biscuit in the basket either, at least as far as, like, on stage. Hannah's shaking her head and stuff because she thinks I'm the smartest man alive, right?
And because you're being very self-deprecating.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. I forgot. but I like dumb
Which
stuff.
Very
I think
comedian of you.
Thank you. Is that thank you? Should nope. I say thank you? Yeah. I'm just trying to take compliments where I can get them. So what's funny is what's unexpected, and sometimes the dumbest thing is unexpected because it doesn't make any sense in that space. Even if it's like you have to be like smart to get to that point, it's very easy to figure out what that point is. A lot of my growing up, because I was short, and because I did ride a unicycle, and because did you not know that?
No.
Yeah, I was a big time unicycler. My first job was building unicycles for the number one
That's
unicyclist
like cool
in the world.
Now.
Yeah.
You used to get made fun of for that?
No one was making fun of me for anything. Like, I was so confident all the time. I got called like Harry Mornos once or twice, or Harry Balls, like that basic shit. But like, no one was picking at me for anything. I lived quite a privileged life for being such a short little shit. But being short, I just wanted to stand out, and unicycling was always something that seemed to make sense. It was funny, and then I was playing basketball. I was in this basketball league when I was pretty young, and we had an 8 a.m. game, and we show up at the gym, and the gym was littered with unicycles and unicyclists, which are their own breed of individual. And I was like, Mom, Dad, we gotta do this. Check it out. And they're like, yeah, let's do it as a family. So everybody in my family started unicycling together. And so that's how I met a lot of clowns, magicians, unicyclists, jugglers, a lot of circus people. I met the Universal Circus people, which is like an all-black circus, and they had a unicycle basketball team, and they dunk off unicycles. It's crazy. What a life. And there are like different levels of unicycling that you can get to. And now unicycling is very like trendy, yeah. I guess, with a lot of off-road unicyclists. I wasn't ever like that great. I'm pretty good, but I was more of the...
That's really a thing?
Yeah. People like jump over. It's wild. Check out the vids. But I was like, perform in parades, which is miserable because you're just like riding a line. But also at like little shows in front of museums and libraries and that sort of crap. In my little white flare jeans and suspenders and my red beret. That was our outfit for the Redford Township Unicycle Club. So I was doing that sort of stuff. I wasn't doing, like, organized LARPing, but as a kid, I was organizing my own sort of LARPing where you also pretended you were, like, an animal of some sort. I called
wait,
it...
Wait, what's LARPing?
Well, live-action role-play. Like, I was into reading fantasy shit, so a lot of acting-y stuff like that. Like, pretend you're a rat, go in the woods, take the sword, and kill each other. Because I was, like, an alpha male kid, even though I was small, my friends would just do whatever I suggested we do. So a lot of kids probably playing medieval rats against their will in the woods. And I played the mandolin because I was small. I was too small for guitar. My guitar teacher told my mom he couldn't teach me how to play with little biscuit grabbers I had for hands. So my mom's like, because my hands are so small. And like my mom's like, this is a cool person's guitar. And she brought on a mandolin. And I was like, who plays that shit? She's like, Bill Monroe. I didn't know who Bill Monroe was, but she knew a name. I was like, that's good enough for me. Turns out it was like all very bluegrassy, very country music. Do you? I didn't at the time, but Led Zeppelin played or REM played, and I was like, I can kind of deal with this. And my mandolin teacher was amazing. He's an incredible musician, a great role model. He's a wonderful figure in my life for a long time. His name is Jared. Shout out to Jared Thompson. I hope you're listening to all my podcasts. I can still play a little bit, dude. Still can't read music. Never been able to, but still play a little bit. So it was just doing all these things. That's all like very comedy related. I played historic baseball, right? 1867 rules baseball, and there are baseball cards of me in old timey clothes. I got paid to play it. So I have all these experiences I can draw from to tell jokes about that are just funny in the idea of like, who would let their kids do this sort of thing? And the answer is over-supportive parents trying to find a way to stay connected to their family, I think. And then the observational stuff is just, I push buttons too. It's a wonder I'm still in a relationship because of all my button pushing. A lot of my humor is, it tiptoes the line of what's appropriate and what's inappropriate. And I think that can really get a gut reaction out of people to laugh pretty hard because they're already uncomfortable, right? So if they're uncomfortable and I make light of the thing they're uncomfortable of, it's alleviating to giggle at it a little bit.
Right. Does all comedy make people, like, is a goal to make people uncomfortable?
It's to make people surprised, I think. Okay. It's to catch people off guard is what the goal of comedy. The goal of comedy is to make people laugh and have a good time.
Right. You said that your jokes are kind of for dumb people, but, like, I consider myself not necessarily dumb, but I fucking love dumb comedy.
That's like, all I meant.
Smart comedy kind of annoys me almost.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't want to be thinking right now. I don't know.
It is too much work.
I'm also slow.
Are you?
Oh, I'm not dumb, but I'm definitely slow.
To clear up what I meant about, like, it's for dumb people, it's very, I feel like anyone can listen to it. There's a 15-year-old kid who lives in this neighborhood who found my video online. He's like, yo, I don't know why you're not more famous than Kevin Hart, dude. And I was like, I don't know, tell your 15-year-old friends to listen to my jokes about doing drugs, kid. I don't know. It's just, there's stuff that people can relate to, and I'm not taking leaps that you need to know a lot about. Like, I might make some references that people are fringe familiar with, but when I was younger, I was doing a lot more, like, literature references or, like, stuff that I thought was highfalutin to come off as highfalutin. And now it's more, there's so many people who just want to laugh. Just make whoever laugh.
Right. And to do so, you kind of have to be relatable.
Yes, absolutely. Or at least speak the language, right?
Right. Before I ask you, like, what other emerging comedians need to know when they're developing their career, can you talk a little bit about the alt comedy scene? Assuming, like, people listening to this don't know much about comedy at all.
So it's not even, like, really a thing anymore. All alt at this point means is comedy shows that aren't in clubs.
Okay.
Right, so like if it's at a brewery or if it's at a record store or at a bookstore, mine's at a bar, right? Mine's in a backyard. All that's alt technically, but what I'd call alt comedy is stuff that's not stand-up punchline. It's very, you almost have to question whether or not it's funny, I think. Whereas club comedy is set up punchline, we're in a comedy club, here's a joke. You'll see the specials of it online, and they're just pretty standard. It's what you think stand-up is what club comedy is.
Okay. Also, you did mention success earlier,
mm-hmm.
So you're moderately successful.
I'd say moderate. I mean, I make money doing stand-up, not like a ton, not enough to get by on out here. I get into festivals and stuff. I haven't been on TV, though, doing stand-up, so like that'd be a nice thing to succeed in. I don't know, I do all right.
Yeah, like, I was going to ask how you define success. Like, what are the benchmarks for you personally? Not for comedy, like in general.
For what I want success-wise, I want an album, which is what I'm working on this year anyway. I have enough material for it. I had a plan for what I want to do. I'm going to reach out to, if you're hearing this laugh fest, I'm reaching out to you. I'm coming out to you in Grand Rapids. It's a Michigan festival. It's very big. but I've performed there a couple times. It's always gone super well, and I'm a Michigan native, so I wanted to see if they'd be down with me recording an album there as one of the shows, because they do so many shows. So that'd be one benchmark to accomplish. Doing a late-night set is another benchmark to accomplish, and this is outside of stand-up, but like I have this pilot, I want to sell that. If I can sell a show and like produce a show, that'll be as much success as I ever need to accomplish in comedy while still wanting to accomplish more. I'll be satisfied. I've succeeded as a comedian to have done that. Same with, I think, an album. A lot of goals are to, like, headline clubs or, like, headline shows. That's always, like, a big goal. The first goal anyone has, I think, is to get paid to do stand-up. I've accomplished that. Next is maybe to get into festivals doing stand-up. I've accomplished that. And then to, like, make it in L.A. And I haven't, like, made it out here, but I'm living out here, and I'm living a pretty good life. So I'd say that's its own form of success as well.
Yeah, totally.
And I'm in a pretty healthy relationship while doing stand-up, which not like a ton of people
success,
are.
That's right?
Yeah. I'd say so.
Hard to come by in the comedy industry?
Well, it's tough. I think for like any entertainment industry, because it's a lot about put all this attention on me, right? So you have to be selfish in a way, and relationships are the exact opposite. It's about understanding someone else. Stand-up, it should be about understanding people, even though it is just you on stage, because it's just you, but also the audience is there as well.
Right.
But as far as, like, going out, I have to go out at night a whole bunch, and I'm not doing it as much as I could be, or as much as I was even in earlier years, because I want to spend time with Hannah, and there's just, like, more responsibility in life. Also, when you are being so self-deprecating all the time, and, like, so in your own head, kind of comes self-centered a lot. Doing stand-up material, because it's all the thoughts you had and the performance you made and like the actions you can take, so you're not doing very much thinking about the person you're with, which is a drag. It's just tough to balance out, or tough to get your mind to build sets.
Right.
Not saying it's impossible. There are a lot of great comedians who are in relationships, but I mean, Hannah and I have been in a relationship since I started taking stand-up seriously, so I'd say that's a success.
So it's kind of a matter of maybe, like, tapering what your expectations are in terms of where you're spending your time, essentially.
I think so.
Yeah.
To succeed, you have to always want more. Otherwise, you'll get to a level and just stop, and then you're done. Stand-up, you have to keep going. Otherwise, you're left in the dust. Like, comedy's changing constantly.
Yeah. What drives you to keep going?
I want to keep making people laugh. I love making people laugh. It makes me feel great, and I love making people feel great.
Between doing, like, a stand-up and writing comedy, are you equally passionate about both? Like,
nope.
When it comes to the pilot and stand-up?
Honestly, like, I'm proud of the show that we've written, and I would love that. The only reason I'm making a show is so I don't have to work a job where I'm not the creative control to split that time, because I feel like if I'm working a show that I created and I'm writing jokes for that, then I'm also writing jokes in general. The job I have right now as an editor, I'm not writing jokes, and that sucks. So
yeah.
I'd rather be performing stand-up all the time, but that's not all that lucrative. And also, like, I don't think it'd allow that much time for future family planning at this point. So I want to be able to make enough money and be particular about when or where I do stand-up.
Right. How do you think that more mature comedians are balancing, like, that family life and their professional careers?
I don't know. I'll go on record saying I don't think Louis is a good dad. Like, straight up. I've never talked to him, or I've never heard anything about how his kids are, but the dude, aside from the creepy, shitty aspect of him,
right,
when he was at his, like, peak of popularity, he's putting out stand-up specials on a yearly basis. He had his own show that he wrote, directed, edited, and starred in. That's 5 full-time jobs. There's no way you can spend enough time with your kids,
right?
Doing that sort of stuff. And that always blew my mind. That always rubbed me the wrong way, even before I knew about the other stuff, which rubs me. It doesn't rub me at all. I don't want to say that. I wouldn't let that rub on me in any way. But there are comedians like the Sklar brothers, who I love. They both have kids, and they work weekends, but they spend a lot of time doing family stuff. I think they just balance out how much they go out and do stand-up, how much time they spend with their kids and with their significant others, how, like, involved in their school systems they are, and then how they can stay around the family making money, because they're in a lot of TV shows. They have 2 podcasts as well. They're working on movies and projects and shit like that.
Like,
so
how do you think they do that? There's not enough time in the day or week to do everything you just...
Well, no, but that's not all at once. That's from project to project. You
okay.
do, like, a thing here, a thing there, and I think they got established in comedy where they were already making money, and, like, no one's like them. So they have more freedom than a lot of people do to, like, raise kids and to, like, have a good life while traveling and doing stand-up. I don't honestly know that many other traveling comedians with children or, like, with significant others. A lot of, like, traveling comedians are divorced, you know, from, like, times past, because how much time are you spending with the person that you're supposed to be spending the most time with. And I don't know how that is in kids or anything. I don't know that many successful comedians with kids, but I'm sure there are more than I'm considering as well, right? Another example is Natasha Leggero and Moshe Kesher, both successful comedians. They're married and they have a kid together, but they've like broadcast the entire thing. Like their whole career is about their whole lives. So
yeah,
it can be like included.
What's their show called?
Their special was called The Honeymoon Special. And it's great. If you haven't seen it, definitely watch it. They both do their own stand-up special and they have a special together where they bring people up on stage and they help them out with their romantic problems. It's so funny. They're masters of their craft. So it's possible. I think you just need to reach a level of monetary comfort and like job stability and some sort of notoriety in the industry where you're not too freaked out about work and you can work on projects from home, wherever your home life is.
I feel like you're saying a lot for where you're at with your day job and your...
I got good balance skills. I'm a unicyclist.
Yeah.
Call back. Get it! Everything comes full circle, like the ultimate wheel. A unicycle with no seat.
Oh, God.
There are different types. I got lists. You getting older, you got to balance everything in life, right? It's just a question of prioritizing stuff. And not to give Hannah too much credit, but she's been very big on trying to get me to organize and plan stuff better. And that really has helped out a lot, even though I'm still, I'd say, a C-minus level planner, organizer. But it does help. So while I'm putting all my focus into one thing at a time, it's been pretty beneficial. When I was putting all the focus into the show, we wrote 30 plus drafts of that thing and like filming it and coming up with what we were going to film and editing it all, that happened over the span of 3 months, right? Mm-hmm. That we just sat down a lot and we're like, we're dedicating time to this, taking time off other stuff. I wasn't doing as much stand-up at that point, but I was still doing, I mean, I've always been doing it regularly, just I've focused less on it and more on this video. But now that that's done, I'm into like the pitch part of it. I'm back into focusing on stand-up. And sometimes I had too many projects, like I was doing Short Boy for a while and Harry Being Bad, which are two like little video things, and a podcast called Yammer Time. But when I was too spaced out, nothing is being done well, and you're not giving enough attention to anyone or anything either. So it's really just a question of limiting yourself to how many projects you're doing at a time and what you believe in. And commitment, again, commitment's big.
Yeah. Do you feel like comedians today need to live in LA or New York to like...
No, for sure they don't. In fact, my big piece of advice is be the shit in your city. Like, stay where you're at, be the shit. Get to be the person there. Because comedians from LA and New York come through every city if your city's like halfway decent. And if you're the shit there, that means you're working with the best comedian coming to town on a regular basis. And then they'll recognize you as the person who was the shit in that scene, as opposed to a person who's pretty good out here with a bunch of people who are also all pretty good. Everyone in LA is already the shit, right? Or they think they are, at the very least. So I'm not saying it's more competitive, it's just there are 5,000 comedians in the city, and in your city there might not even be 5,000 women. Who fucking knows, right? So be the bomb where you're at. Be nice to people. I think that matters a whole bunch. Write a ton, go out a ton, commit. Well, it's great to have friends, have as many friends as you can, but don't get involved in other people's fights unless you need to.
Why with the friend thing for comedy specifically?
Well, you want to be friends with other comedians because they tell you about other opportunities and they help you build your material, and like you're in the same business. You'll be with them forever. And also, when you're doing so much comedy, the friends who aren't comedians might fall by the wayside and feel pretty bad about it. So you have to like balance out those sort of relationships as well. But also, a lot of times in the comedy scenes, especially right now, there's a lot of drama going on. It's whatever people think high school is what the working world is. Every class in comedy, gossip travels big time, and you can get caught up in other people's bullshit pretty easily, and it can kind of blackball you from some places. So take a stance when you know what you're taking a stance for. Like, that should be the case no matter whether that's in comedy or in just your life. Do some research on what you're standing up for and who you're standing with if you're going to do that sort of thing.
Last question that I ask everyone. What's something you're excited about today?
Today, going to a comedy show. Always excited about that. I love seeing comedy still. I get excited just to watch it. Excited to be having you at our place. It's always fun hanging out with you. That's a blast. I'm giving a whole bunch of stuff I'm excited about.
Yeah.
I'm excited about this pork tenderloin, walnut crusted, cooked recently in the oven that I've smelled since my hair was getting trimmed off. And I'm excited for the first person to come up to me and be like, yo, Harry, that new haircut? Damn, dude. Who cut that shit? And I'll be like, Hannah! And just point right at you, and Hannah will be like, oh my God. And I'll get it all on Instagram and you can watch.
Cool. Where can people find you?
At HR Moros, like human resources Moros, on all platforms. All right. Instagram, Twitter. I don't know what other platforms. I'm probably on one of the sneaker sites. Find me there. I've got accounts. Go to harrymoros.com. That's my website. Come see me live if you're in LA at Crane's Comedy every second Wednesday of the month, or at the Dirt Pit Lounge, which is on Saturdays monthly. I don't know. Look me up on Instagram. You'll see when Dirt Pit Lounge is happening. I've got more dates. Let's see. I don't know how recently. I don't know when this is going to drop. Oh, we're done? We're done? You guys don't want more? Check out Short Boys. That's on Instagram. Check out Here Be Bad.
Okay.
And look for my show on Cartoon Network in the year 2020.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's been a blast, Shannon.
Yeah, it's been fun.